This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhibi in Washington. And here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We need to completely reevaluate biomedical innovation and how drugs, vaccines, and diagnostic tools are developed and how they're shared equitably across the world. It is not right now a system that favors public health. It is a system that favors commercialization and commerce and big business.
That was Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign to ensure equal distribution of vaccines to poorer countries. Details coming up. Also, gunmen abduct 300 schoolgirls in Nigeria's Zamfara state. And Zimbabwe allocates $300 million to rebuild its poorly maintained roads. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, we start with our top story. According to officials, gunmen in Nigeria have abducted more than 300 girls from a government secondary school in northwest Zamfara state. It is the fourth such mass abduction of schoolchildren since December and will only add to mounting criticism of authorities' failure to protect schools. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
State security officials said the attack happened in the town of Jangebe shortly after midnight Thursday. More than 100 gunmen raided the secondary school and herded 317 girls into the nearby bush. Another 54 girls managed to hide and avoid their would-be captors. Security forces and local vigilante groups are looking for the abducted schoolgirls. No group has claimed responsibility. This is the fourth such mass abduction of students in Nigeria since December, sparking accusations that the government is unable to provide adequate school security. Senator Irebu is a security expert and founder of security magazine, The Global Sentinel.
They are getting bolder and bolder due to the body language of the state actors that seems incapable of running on these terrorists, terrorizing the whole almost northwest, north central, and even going towards the downside of the country.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, released a statement Friday calling the attack a gross violation of children's rights. The Bring Back Our Girls BBOG movement, founded after the kidnapping of the Chibok girls in 2014, said it is monitoring the incident closely. Florence Ozor is the head of BBOG.
We've just been made aware, still waiting to get more information. It just happened, right? So everybody is sitting in the dark as to where things are.
Kidnapping for ransom is becoming increasingly rampant in Nigeria's northern areas and often carried out by criminal gangs. The attack comes just over a week after gunmen abducted 27 schoolboys and 15 others in central Niger state. None of the abductees has been released. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The latest mass abduction is adding pressure on the Nigerian government to take action to the ongoing problem, saying parents are increasingly unwilling to put the children in boarding schools. There also are concerns about the psychological impact on students who are kidnapped and those affected by fear of it happening. Professor Khalifa Ali Dekwa is an educationist and an expert in sociolinguistic and international relations. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye about the abductions and how the student will be traumatized.
It is a cumulative effect of bad governance from the 80s, where the leaders and the followers went to different schools, different hospitals. Their children went to different hospitals, different schools, and neglecting the children of nobody, the elite decided to be selfish, greedy, and self-centered. And those who are denied education, denied jobs, and so on, are today taking the world to the elite. And therefore, the best way now is to say sorry. Let us fix the institutions, the hospitals, the schools, to be fathered so that our children and their own children will go to the same institution as it was in the past.
Do you think these abductions in different parts of Nigeria could make parents reluctant to send their children to schools?
No parent will ever contemplate sending his own children only to be abducted. Even if the children are brave enough to go to school, the possibility of they being traumatized, not concentrating, is very high. And therefore, you cannot learn in an environment of fear. So this is the thing. Let us do this. As a government, Nigeria is a very big country. The security agencies are overwhelmed. They can't do it because every year many retire. Others are not recruited to replace them in terms of numbers. And Nigeria is expanding, a country of over 200 million with less than 1 million security agencies and so on. And that it is a shame. It is a shame that we do not want others to also enjoy the public resources. Give them education. Nigeria can afford to give free education from primary to university if the resources are not looted by the elite.
What should be done to check the trend, especially as the abductors use it as a money-making venture?
The best way is to quickly adopt technology, train the security officers, pay them very well, and give them marching orders. They either do way and do very good, excellently, or they are out. And keep the children, encourage them, give the children the option of going into technology. This foolishness of going only to university is not helping, because polytechnics and other institutions are equally important, and therefore make education affordable to everyone. Nigeria can afford it. If our children are denied education, the possibility is that those of us in the cities are not going to sleep again, nor our children. And therefore, it is better to let them also have access to the public wealth.
That was Professor Khalifa Ali Dikwa, an educationist, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye by phone from Maiduguri. International aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has expressed concern over what it calls late COVID-19 vaccine deliveries to poorer nations under a global procurement initiative known as COVAX. The group is calling for postponing deliveries to wealthy countries to enable at-risk people living in developing countries so that they can get a shot. International Edition's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for MSF's Access Campaign.
WHO has set very clear guidance as the lead global health agency that we should be vaccinating the highest at-risk people in every country before we are extending vaccination to low-risk populations. So I understand that folks might think it's unfair if governments have contributed so much public funding to the research and development and the manufacturing. If we are looking at opening economies again, if we're looking at truly saving the most lives, if we're looking at ending this pandemic, we have to use those vaccines, that scarce supply, in the smartest way possible. Despite that framework, we have a severe inequity between wealthy governments that have gobbled up the vast majority of these vaccine supplies and the about 130 countries that haven't yet been able to administer a single dose of COVID-19 vaccines. Many of those countries relying heavily on the global procurement mechanism called the COVAX facility.
Don't you think you're fighting against the optics and even the politics of it? How would a population or a country react if they knew that their country is sending COVID vaccines to other countries when they have not gotten a shot?
Well, I mean, I think we live in such a globalized world. I think people understand that now, especially in light of this pandemic and how rapidly it's spread. We are not isolated countries. Our borders are not closed. We have to think commonly. I know it's very much right now, over the past few years, seemingly governments have become more insular. Seemingly some people have become, as livelihoods are under threat, as people face many challenges, sometimes it's hard to really think globally. But I think for the most part, people understand. They understand that we're part of a global ecosystem, and really that this pandemic itself illustrated that so clearly. So I know everybody wants their vaccine, for sure. Everybody should have access to their vaccine. We need to look at some of the systemic roots of the biomedical innovation system that landed us in this horrible situation where we have too few vaccines for the world, right? And there is a lot to unpack there. The reason why we are in this situation is because we've been conducting vaccine development, and who gets access to these vaccines really is business as usual, despite the tens of billions of dollars of public funding that's been put into it.
Do you think this is a failure of the COVAX system?
The COVAX system right now, it is the globally agreed upon procurement mechanism. We do think there are many limitations to that system. We made recommendations back at the beginning of the summer and the spring of last year when the COVAX facility was being constructed. We made, as MSF, recommendations in terms of the architecture and the policies that the COVAX facility should have adopted if we were going to progress more and be more ambitious and deliver more for governments. Many of those recommendations weren't taken. Nevertheless, we're at the place where that is the global procurement mechanism. So we really have to make sure that it's successful.
What would you suggest to make the system more successful and also better?
First and foremost, we need to go back to the roots of this system that have landed us in this place. We need to completely reevaluate biomedical innovation and how drugs, vaccines, and diagnostic tools are developed and how they're shared equitably across the world. It is not right now a system that favors public health. It is a system that favors commercialization and commerce and big business.
That was Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for MSF's Access Campaign, speaking with VOA's Chinedu Ofor. As countries kick off vaccination campaign in Africa amid mistrust over COVID-19 vaccine efficacy, health ministers are among the first ones to take the shots. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on Senegal and Zimbabwe, two countries that began inoculating their populations using Sinopharm, the Chinese-made COVID-19 vaccine.
Senegal received 200,000 doses of the Chinese-made COVID-19 vaccine last week and started vaccinating on Tuesday. Health Minister Abdoulaye Diouf Sarr was the first in line to mark what he called a historic day.
That is to have in Senegal.
Senegal is one of seven countries among the 54 countries of the African continent to start the vaccination against COVID-19.
Priorities include healthcare workers, people over 60, and those with underlying health conditions. SAR says in addition to the Chinese vaccine, the country is also looking at other possibilities to increase their stock.
The head of state is now finalizing talks with Russia to enable us to soon receive the Sputnik V. During the month of March, Senegal will also receive its first batch of the COVAX initiative.
Senegal is due to receive nearly 1.3 million vaccine doses through the World Health Organization-led COVAX initiative, which deployed a batch of 600,000 in Ghana this week as part of a first wave of coronavirus vaccines being sent to a number of low- and middle-income countries. In Zimbabwe, Vice President Constantino Chiwenga, also the country's health minister, volunteered for the first Chinese-made vaccine as well. Amid reports of public mistrust over vaccine safety, Chiwenga said his ministry had done its homework.
My ministry conducted all scientific processes to ascertain the efficacy of Sinopharm vaccine, which was confirmed to be 79%.
Zimbabwe received 200,000 doses from the Sinopharm vaccine as a donation from the Chinese government. Another 600,000 doses purchased by Zimbabwe are expected to arrive early next week, according to government officials. Vaccine recipient Michael Chideme says he's relieved to have taken the shot, but
taking the jab does not mean I will not be able to, I will not get the disease if I don't practice caution. But I'll be extra cautious, but I'm happy I've taken the jab.
Zimbabwe, like many other African countries, initially recorded low coronavirus numbers in the first months of the pandemic, but subsequently saw cases go up. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
A new report by Amnesty International details the systematic killing of hundreds of civilians on the 28th and 29th of November by Eritrean troops in the historic city of Aksum in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Gathering information from interviews with more than 40 survivors and witnesses of the attack, as well as others with knowledge of the events, Amnesty collected consistent accounts of looting, indiscriminate shelling, and extrajudicial killings. The human rights group says it may amount to crimes against humanity. VOA Salem Salomon spoke to the author of the report, Jean-Baptiste Galopin.
The massacre took place in retaliation for an attempt by a small group of pro-TPLF fighters to attack an Eritrean base on a mountain in the middle of the city. And in retaliation for this attack, Eritrean forces shot wantonly at civilians and killed, we believe, hundreds of people over the course of roughly 24 hours. They also went around carrying house-to-house searchers and dragging Muslim men out of their homes and shooting them on the streets or killing them in their homes. So this is really the main finding of our research. We've also documented indiscriminate shelling during the attack on the city by the joint Ethiopian and Eritrean forces on the 19th of November, as well as arbitrary mass detentions by Eritrean forces of civilians in the aftermath of the massacre, with clear threats to resume the killing in the event of new resistance. And we've also documented widespread and seemingly systematic looting by Eritrean forces of civilian property.
Until now, there hasn't been really confirmation about who the perpetrators are. You mentioned the trigger of this massacre that you're talking about. Did I hear you say Eritrean base in the Tigray region?
Yes. Yeah, so after the joint force of Ethiopian and Eritrean soldiers entered the city on the 19th of November, Eritrean soldiers set up a base on in a school which on this mountain which overlooks the city called Maikuho. And this is where the fighting took place in the morning of the 28th of November. And it's unclear how long the fighting started, but witnesses describe very trained Eritrean soldiers routing the fighters on the other side. Many actually men from Aksum joined the fight with sticks and rocks and were shot with full sniper rifles and machine guns.
What is the government of Ethiopia saying about this? Has there been any admission and action? You mentioned also about looting. One of the key information that we've been learning is that humanitarian food has been either looted or not being able to pass through to get to vulnerable people. If you could share a little bit about who is actually looting humanitarian aid, and why is it not getting into the hands of vulnerable people who are basically, on the verge of starvation?
So we've shared our findings. We shared our findings with the Ambassador Ridwan Hussein, the State Minister of Foreign Affairs. And at the time of writing, we hadn't received a response. We still haven't received a response from the Ethiopian government. So we don't know what the Ethiopian government has done to address these abuses. To address the question of looting, the looting, as I mentioned, was widespread and systematic. Eritrean forces looted hotels, factories, homes, government buildings, hospitals, shops, storage of food, and they also looted all sorts of objects, machinery, including water pumps and, you know, bakery equipment and generators. They looted, you know, cooking oil, lentils, flour. They looted valuables in, you know, jewelry shops. They looted medication in the hospitals, according to witnesses. So it was very widespread and systematic. And so we call on UN-led investigation into these crimes. As you know, in international humanitarian law, indiscriminate attacks and deliberate attacks on civilians are war crimes. And the shelling, so the shelling of the city in the initial attack would fit these definitions. And in international humanitarian law, they, when attacks against civilians are widespread and systematic, they're crimes against humanity. And it seems pretty clear from the witnesses that the attack on civilians on the 28th and the 29th of November by Eritrean forces was a deliberate attempt to subdue any resistance in the city by terrorizing the population. And the another evidence for that is the mass detention of civilians by the Eritrean forces in the aftermath of the massacre and the very explicit threat that Eritrean officers you know, made of renewing the killing in the events of new resistance. So we call on the UN-led investigation into these events. We also call on the Ethiopian government to grant unfettered access to Tigray, not only to humanitarian organizations, but also to human rights and media organizations.
That was Amnesty International's Jean-Baptiste Galopin speaking with VOA Salem Salomon. Eritrean Minister of Information Yamana Maskal responded that Eritrea is outraged and categorically rejects the preposterous accusations in the report, claiming it is largely based on testimonies of some 31 individuals from Hamdiyet refugee camp in the Sudan. Zimbabwe has declared a state of emergency on its poorly maintained roads, allocating about $300 million towards rehabilitation of the critical infrastructure. Reporter Kunza Zanwashi has the details.
That is the sound of vehicles slowly navigating the potholes that have become so painfully common in Zimbabwe's urban centers. The state of emergency follows release of government plans to resolve the road crisis. Monica Mutswangwa is the Minister of Information.
All the repair of roads which have been damaged by the current rains as well as previous cyclones, Cabinet approved an emergency road rehabilitation program consisting of corrective, preventive and restoration works. The project will take up an initial $80 million for emergency roadworks covering 60 days, then $120 million for preventive works spanning for 6 months, then another $120 million for rehabilitation and reconstruction works spanning 6 to 18 months, and $80 million for other related works spanning 18 to 36 months.
Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst.
I think it's a good decision that the government is investing in road or infrastructure rehabilitation. But if you combine this response to repair our infrastructure, linking it with the millions of dollars being spent on the statue of the first revolt in Zimbabwe, you get a sense that there's no sense of proper planning in terms of government programs.
During the pandemic, government announced construction of the statue of Mbuya Nehanda, the leader of the first revolution against white minority rule. Mukundu says actions and policies by the ZANU-PF-led government are too reactive.
there's a knee-jerk reaction to government programs. There is a political reaction. So they look at the roads infrastructure and they say it's an opportunity to undermine the MDC councils. They look at the Mbuyana under statue and say it's an opportunity to project the image of ZANU-PF as the inheritors and the guardians of our history and our heritage. So almost all the interventions by this government are anchored on politics and power retention, and not necessarily informed by a national vision of developing this country.
There is a silver lining for mechanics who often have to fix suspension of cars battered by Zimbabwe's dilapidated roads. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Aparo, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.